A thing doesn't have to be perfect to be brilliant. Hold on a second, Harlem's happening. Okay, let's go. Here we go. Welcome to Casually Brilliant, a Zooms with Friends Masterclass podcast series. I'm your host, Ebony Janice. Each week for the next several weeks, I will share casual conversations with some of my closest friends and faves on various topics, including race, faith, healing, mental health, music, the metaphysical world, and anywhere else our casual brilliance takes us in the conversation. Today's special guests are Khadijah and Zakiya of Unearth and Bloom. I'm so excited for you to hear today's Casually Brilliant conversation with these intergenerational healers and dreamers.
Thank you all for agreeing to have this conversation with me. I love your work. I loved your work before I even knew deeply what it was. I just love the name Unearth and Bloom. I love it.
Thank you. It took a while to come up with that name. We had so many, there were so many things rooted and it was like blue and something. Like, we wanted something that really identified us and something mm-hmm. that would just speak to exactly what we do.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it was, where were we when we spent a long time on it? And then we were at a cafe. We're at a cafe right there down the street, that little small cafe that had the antique stuff in it, remember?
Yeah, we were
in that cafe. And I was like, I think I like Unearth.
Yeah.
And then we start writing it down. Like, how does it look? Because what I thought about Unearth, like, I was always thinking about something earthy because we're earth signs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And also, for us, we were thinking about our roots. So we thought about New Orleans, and, you know, mm-hmm. and everything that we do is like intergenerational. So mm-hmm. we always think back to our roots. So we wanted to like give homage to where we came from. We're like, okay, how can we include all of this in our work? And then Unearth came out.
Yeah.
And then healing and growth and all that stuff came out of like blooming and how we kind of like transition from like mm-hmm. Unearth and then the transition part and then bloom and change it to something new.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I came into knowing of you all maybe about October, November of last year. And last year I was doing just a lot of deep therapy work, deep work. And I was in therapy like 2 days a week. If I had the money, cause I'm paying for this out of my pocket. If I had the money, I'd have been there more. If I had the money, I would just go to therapy every day and just be like, girl, I'm good. But I just came to see what's going on. What you doing? We're good. And that's what I was experiencing. I feel like that label, that idea of Unearth and Bloom really resonated with me, because that's kind of what I was unearthing so much. And I was also doing a lot of deep worthiness healing. Or I'll say this backwards. I'm the manifestation queen. And in doing manifestation work, manifestation work would just show you like, oh, that's an issue. Like, you don't feel worthy of that. That's why you got to call that to you, because you need to work out that, you know, unworthiness. And that stuff, like being unearthed, you know, like has been very major for me. So I immediately resonated with that name. And then I saw that y'all were twins, which is cute. Don't people just love twins?
That's what they say, girl.
My grandma has 6 girls. And of the 6 girls, 3 of them had sets of twins. So I have 3 sets of twins in my immediate
cousin. Wow. Because we go back and forth. We're like, girl, which one of us having twins? I'm having twins. I am.
The fact that both of y'all at the same time, it's me.
we both had abundance.
Abundance, yeah.
Let's both just have them. We both got them.
Everybody have twins, except for me.
Oh.
Y'all go ahead and have the twins, and I will be Auntie Eb, and I will go home. You can drop them off, but come back and get them.
I actually been thinking about triplets. Ooh. I don't know where that came from.
Okay.
But more recently, I've been like, triplets. Ministry.
God bless you. Yeah.
That unfolds. I mean,
when I was younger and dumber, I wanted 8. Yeah, younger and dumber. I wanted 8 children. What was I thinking about?
I wanted 5. Yeah. I mean, 8 is a lot. But you come from a big family.
Yeah, I'm from a big family. Very much so. But I don't think that I say younger and dumber, which that ain't great language, but that's what it was. I was an idiot. And I wanted 8 babies with this particular man. Girl, God, thank you that you didn't give me, that you gave me negative 8 babies with that man.
Yo, I told the guy who I was with for a long time, I said, I want 5 kids. And he was like, I'm not having 5 kids. I was like, listen, I'm having 5 kids. Now, whether you're going to be there for this, that's up to you. But out of me, I'm giving birth to 5.
So that was the thing. It was like understanding that these people had to come out of my body. And that's really what brought me back to myself. Like, wait a minute, Dama, where are the babies going to come from now?
Like, wait a minute. Hold up. So like, 8? I don't know. I wanted 5, 6. Twice. I wanted twins. You know, 5, 6. I mean, I'm still, I don't know, have a mini, Lord. I'll take them.
So, I would like to have children, if that is God's will for my life. But I have, I'm from a big family. And my oldest sister had my oldest nephew when I was 17 years old, and I saw her give birth to him, and I saw her get that epidural. And I have had, you know, long bouts of celibacy as a result of that birth control as a young girl, because I saw that with my eyeballs and was just like, oh, this is how it happens.
I'm good. Yeah. Yeah. None of that. Yeah. I actually started looking at, as I got older, I started looking at birth a little bit different. And it wasn't about like the amount of kids I wanted or the number of children. It was all about like the process. Mm. You know, I started meeting doulas and I started thinking what it meant to give birth. And I started understanding birthing in a completely different way, like birth to our vision, giving birth to actual human beings, and like, what does that mean and the process of that. And then how, you know, you take care of your body, and you take care of your spiritual, mental and emotional, you know, space and all of that. And how, you know, when we talk about intergenerational healing, thinking about how much I have to take care of myself in order to, you know, for this baby who's being born can born into the world free of trauma, you know. Mm-hmm. So I just started thinking about a lot of things, and I'm like, okay, you know, so numbers didn't really, I mean, I still want my triplets, but as far as like, really being focused on, I want these 5 kids, I started to really focus on, what does it mean to give birth? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've spoken to, what do you call them, spiritual guides? Mm-hmm. Spiritual guides, yeah. Spiritual guides, I've spoken to spiritual guides before, that would be like, I see birth, right? I see a baby or something like giving birth. Mm-hmm. Later, it'll be like, oh, I have this idea for a business or something like that. Be like, that's what you was talking about this whole time. I'm right. Thinking like, yeah. A physical
thing,
but it's maybe, you know, actual human, but it's like, oh, business and stuff like that. I'm like, oh, okay, so birthing could mean different things.
Yeah, thank you for saying what you said about just continuing to bring up intergenerational healing and this idea, because it actually makes me think about part of the reason why I might be very like whatever about having multiple pregnancies. I would like to have one pregnancy, and however many kids is going to happen need to happen in that one shot. So,
yeah.
But also, because I do have so many nieces and nephews, I also feel like, should I have multiple children, I need somebody to come get these babies. Like, every day, at the very least for X amount of time, come get these babies, because I'll say this, and this ain't even where I was trying to go. I was trying to go to trauma. But I was just thinking about the fact that I have so many. I think that we're definitely, we're not far from age mates. We're not far. I think we're like a year apart.
Probably.
I was trying to make myself so old sometimes, y'all. But I have so many. I think we're at the age where we have a lot of friends that do have children now. And one of the things that I've realized with a lot of my girlfriends that have had children is that they had children and they became somebody's mom. And so what happened is like this very funny, joyful, creative being has no space to exist anymore because this identity of motherhood has, you know, taken over. And because I have been working on healing a lot of my own stuff with my own mom, thinking about that intergenerational piece, that feels very important to me to and that could be some of my resistance to having a lot of children too, because I'm very much committed to like, I never want to put myself in a situation where I can't be my whole self because these little nappy-headed children running around here and I don't have any time to even think for myself. So that trauma piece also, I was going to connect it to thinking about how I have seen, being 17, seeing somebody get an epidural is a traumatic experience. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I should have seen that with my eyeballs at such a young age. And it started to create a story for me about the pain of birth. And then having another sister that has had to have a C-section. And then maybe even my own birth story being a little traumatic in that my mom was in labor for 1,000 hours and then my grandmother slapped her and she released and I finally came out. So like there's maybe some trauma even in that. Or thinking about my grandmother having some traumatic stories and my mother having lost a baby through miscarriage right before me. Like thinking about the energy of like, so some of that could be like kind of resonating with me, sitting with me at this age.
My mom talks about how it was painful. Like she used to tell us all the time, it was painful. You know, when I had a baby, it was painful. You know, it was so painful. And we're like, why do you have so many? Yeah. She's like, afterwards you forget about the pain. Yeah. And now you have your babies and you go and you get pregnant again. And it's not really until it's almost time to have that baby and give birth to that baby that you think about what you went through. And now, then you have all these panics. And I'm like, but mom, you did that a lot of times. And she's like,
I'm saying, girl, you love that man. Cause you did that several times.
Yeah. She's like, well, yeah, this is what happened. But also, you talked about this idea of mothering as well. And I remember, I think it was, Nikki Giovanni. Was it Nikki Giovanni? Yeah. I think it was Nikki Giovanni talked about, having her daughter, Nikki Giovanni talked about this idea of mothering and how she didn't want to be identified just as a mother. Mm-hmm. Like, I made it clear that, you know, I'm not just a mother. Mm-hmm. I had all of these things before I was a mother, and then now I'm a mother, all of those things aren't going away. So I'm one of many, like, mother is, like, one of my identities. Mm-hmm. And that, what our mama was completely different.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Right. Well, meaning that my mama was, like, and we say my mama. We all say my mama. Are you talking about
that too with my dad? We be like, my dad. This is my dad too.
Yeah, explain what you mean. Like, my mama was like a mom and did other things.
No, she was locked into her money.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But even until now, like, my mom became a mom, like that,
she
like,
was a mom
all the way through. And now as an adult, you know, we oftentimes tell her like, mom, you know, who's Mary? Like, who are you as an outside of motherhood? And we will always be there. We'll always be your babies. If, you know, we will always be yours. And, you know, you have room and space to identify who you are for yourself. And that can be difficult after 30-something years.
Yeah, of course.
Of being, being a mother.
She was married to my dad. She was married to my dad young. And then had children young. And so now we're all adults and my mom is not that much older than me. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like, we can all have fun together. But she was really, really into, like, I'm talking about like at school every day and after school setting up to say, like, she was that stay-at-home mom and she embodied it. Like, I feel like she loved that to the point where, like, even now she's like, I just want to open up a theater for like kids. Do like all this other stuff, like I think too, and talking about just getting into a little bit of the trauma piece, I think part of the reason why my mother and mothering, why she was so like so a part of who we were, like literally volunteer at our school up until we got to high school, I think she was afraid of the world around us.
Yeah.
So she always
We grew up in a Muslim Christian household.
Yeah.
And so we used to pray a lot. You know, but one thing mom used to do was like put a cross over our head, put like the blessed oil, which is like, you know, the extra virgin olive oil on our head before we left the house. And she was just so fearful of the world around us. Yeah. So that mother, we felt her as a mother, but not only was she like oftentimes like our mother in the house, but she was like literally always there with us. Mm-hmm. Even now, my mom has to talk to us every single day. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All of her kids, like, she has to talk. Don't talk to one, she's like, hey, have you talked to this person? Mm-hmm. Have you talked to that person? And it's still a part of like really her being really attached to us and her being afraid of like a lot of her experience, what happened around us, and trying to you know, have that not happen with us.
And like, as I hear you saying that, recalling like what, like the knowledge of intergenerational trauma and kind of like fear, right? And so my mom's, her world wasn't safe. Mm-hmm. And so she introduced that unconsciously, introduced that this world isn't safe to us. Mm-hmm. She protected us and we didn't even realize that was her protection. It was just kind of like, oh, this is what moms do. Mm-hmm. And yeah. As we were old, like, whoa, mom was like, but we felt super safe.
Yeah.
Like we knew which streets to walk down in West Oakland, which to not walk down, right? We knew where to go when we was in New Orleans and where not to go. Like we just knew those things, that we knew how to pray and all that stuff and how to stay safe because she made sure that we knew that stuff. But mm-hmm. she instilled in us that this world wasn't safe essentially because her world wasn't necessarily mm-hmm. safe.
Yeah, well, I've had a very similar mother that had her girls very young, 18, 20, 22. And when I think about that as an adult, like what would I have done with three daughters at the age of 22? Yikes.
Yeah.
But that's, so think about like being 18 and you know, you got babies, you know, already. It's ultimately has been her identity. It's been being somebody's mama and then somebody's wife and then somebody's grandmother. And I was having a conversation literally like 3 days ago with my mom, because as we're talking about mothering, I'm also very clear that a part of my ease about whatever happens with me having children or not, and I expect to have children, but whether I have people come out of my body or not, I have been raising children, you know, like, so I have mothered and am mothering children. And I was talking to my mom about that the other day, and she was like, you ain't no mama because you could leave too easy. And we ended the conversation, but I do journaling first thing in the morning. That came up for me in the morning. I was like, that was actually very offensive to me because it's not easy for me to leave. I was just with my family a couple of weeks ago when I left, you know.
Yeah.
It's always a thing. And I was, yeah. It's not easy for me to leave, but what I have for myself that I got from, that my mother doesn't have for herself is that choosing myself doesn't mean that I don't love any other people. That choosing myself makes me a better sister, friend, daughter, all the things. And, mm-hmm. I was talking to my mom about that later, and I was like, I feel like that's a part of the thing that you have never really interrogated for yourself, is that you choose us no matter what, even if it hurts you. Like, as a full-grown woman, your baby is 37, mm-hmm. and you choose us even if it hurts you. And so then you get offended and hurt if we don't do the same thing, because yeah. in your mind, you have connected choosing other people over yourself with love. And that's not the best. That doesn't serve any of us. It certainly doesn't serve me if I ask you for something and you do it with the expectation that I would do that same exact thing for you, even if I don't have the capacity to. And it was hard for her to receive that, but we ended the conversation with my mom really being like, I got that. I see that. I see how I have spent a lifetime being like, I'm gonna do whatever I gotta do for my family. Even if it hurts you, it doesn't. I was saying, I call it, I was actually just talking to another girlfriend about this earlier today, using this language. Did nobody ask you to be Holy Ghost Junior?
Holy Ghost Junior.
Nobody asked you to be Holy Ghost Junior. And that is what I feel like oftentimes when you get into the role of being a mother, you get that for yourself. Like, oh, I have to play God's secretary. So let me do all these things. And nobody asked you to do that. And I don't know where it came from. I love the language that y'all use around intergenerational healing and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, just always including that intergenerational piece of it, because perhaps it is an ancestor. Perhaps it was a great grandmother. You know, I didn't necessarily see it with my immediate grandmothers, with my parents' mothers or fathers, but you know, maybe a great grandmother who was just like, this is hard, but we're gonna be free and you know, whatever, by any means necessary. Because that's not really the story of the women in my family. But for me, it has at some point been like, I can't die to save whatever it is we think we're doing here. In fact, it benefits all of us if somebody get free, you know what I'm saying? If somebody figures out how to be well. And
That's also like a history and expectation of Black women as well, to like operate in, and we call it like selfless.
I'm
being selfless. But to who? Because like, what about yourself first? You know, saying, actually, I get to take care of myself. I get to say no. I get to move how I want. Because I need to free myself and I need to get free.
Yeah.
And if I'm no good for myself, then I'm no good to anyone else around me. So I think there's always this like, and I find myself, I can't say that I'm like, I'm not that person, because there are moments and there are days when I'm very much like hopping into that role and figuring out, figuring that I have to be like a savior for everybody. And I, and this is my role to jump in. And I convince myself that it's a selfless act, and you know, I'm doing this because I care, and really like, no, I do this because I think that's my responsibility. So I haven't untrained myself to say that this is not yours to carry, like you don't have to do this. Carry yourself. I would also add, and the thing about intergenerational trauma is when we talk about that, we kind of, I like to focus more on the intergenerational healing aspect of it. Intergenerational trauma a lot, right? And you hear a lot of people say break generational curses. We want to break generational curses, right? That sounds challenging. Right? Think about generations that came before you, known and unknown. Of course, yeah, we hold some of these traumas in our body of ancestors that they've experienced, right? Known and unknown. And so for us to put that task on us to break the generational curse, it could be hard. It could look hard. I've seen people take that approach, and it has looked challenging. And not saying that it's going to always look easy, but when we come from an aspect of introducing intergenerational healing, that's a little bit more soothing because that looks different, right? And so in order to heal, it doesn't have to be hard. Sometimes it is, but it doesn't have to be. It gets beautiful at times because we learn more about what our ancestors and our people before us experienced. We have open dialogue and conversations, right, with people that came before us. And we also do things like, right, we also do things like yoga and stretching and breathing and meditating and introducing that healing within our mind and our body. You know what's hard? I think earlier we were talking about this secrecy that happens within families and, you know, and wanting to keep a certain secret within a certain like generation. And so like the next generation won't know our secrets and we get, you know, not in an intentional way, but like the next generation don't have to deal with this. So let's not tell them, right? We're talking about health within our family. And, you know, we're talking about how sometimes we deal with anxiety and we're like, what the heck is this? What is coming from? And then we talk to like my uncle about it. And he's like, your grandma suffered with anxiety. And we're like, what? Why nobody? Like, this stuff is like generational. Like, this is interesting. But amongst siblings, we hold it and not tell one another. We have had a conversation about being transparent to one another because we don't know that people in our past have dealt with this. It wasn't a normalized thing to talk about. So now amongst ourselves, we're like, am I tripping? You know, what's happening with me? Okay, let me just sort of like be quiet. Not be quiet, not say nothing, but let me be quiet and try to figure out what's happening. And like, am I like, is this anxiety? Is that what's coming up? And if so, where did this come from? How did this happen? And then you find out like another sibling has been suffering from the same thing. And then you find out, like, oh mom, like you had anxiety too. Oh, grandma, you know, used to go through anxiety as well. You know, so you find out things, you know, after you are now immersed in it and you're trying to figure out what's wrong with you. You know, and how can I address this? How can I get over this? You know, is this thing only happening to me? You find out that it's nothing new within
this
the family.
This is womanism in Alice Walker's definition of womanism. There's like, you know, the four-part definition, and one part of the definition, which is my favorite part because it is in this intergenerational conversation, It says, a daughter says to her mother, Mama, I'm going to Canada. I'm taking several other slaves with me. And the mother says to the daughter, you wouldn't be the first. And it's like, if it weren't for that conversation, that's what I walk away from it with. It's like the willingness to have the conversation, to say out loud, Mama, this is what I'm going through, or Mama, this is what I'm about to do, or and or vice versa, you know, for the elders to be willing to say, like, this is what we're doing. And it's like in that moment you realize you wouldn't be the first. Like, you think you're doing some, you think you're having on either end of the spectrum, you know, and everything in between. You think, like, I'm the only one having this experience. And then you open up your mouth and you find out. I have polycystic ovarian syndrome, which I have, I'm just telling all of my business. But so I have irregular menstrual cycles since I was a teenager. And I maybe was like 20, I don't know how old I was. It was 2011, however old I was then. And I was really going through some deep sickness, some deep depression and some deep physical sickness at the same time. And one of my aunts heard about it and called me and was like, yeah, Mama, talking about my grandmother, something, she has something. And they called the doctor to find out what it was. And the way that they had labeled it all those years ago when my grandmother was still having a cycle was irregular menstrual hemorrhaging. They didn't have the language of PCOS, but it very likely was the same thing. And it's like, even think about how even in our bodies, like these physical ailments, these emotional, spiritual things that we're maneuvering through, and because we're not talking enough often, you know, just having those like cross-generational conversations, we don't know that we're missing out on the antidote. When I said the word antidote, I got hip-hop Tourette's, and so I thought about this too, James. I almost went there, so.
Long ago that we, I don't know if my mom see this, she probably called me yelling. What you about to say, Khadija? Wait, what you about to say?
Oh, I be telling all the business, so here we are.
No, because I was talking to you that we found out that my grandmother actually like was connected, like doing spiritual work. Mm-hmm. With like root work. Mm-hmm. And here we are, we're like, oh, let's dab into this and let's dip in and let's do all this stuff. And then, you know, I talk to my mom about it and my mom is telling me everything. And I'm like, Mom, what? And she's like, oh, I know all about that. I know this and this and that. I know this. And I'm like, Mom, why haven't you said anything? She's like, you know, and this idea of like even holding those gifts.
Yeah.
Or even, you know, we're not really sharing those gifts, or even not really sharing the honesty around these are the gifts that I had, and this is how I view the gifts later on, and now I don't use those gifts anymore. So, you know, so when those gifts come up for us, we're like, what's happening? Grandma. Yeah.
No, that's I'm looking at, you know, the zipped lip over here, but let's deal with this for a second, because that actually reminds me, that's why I started following y'all. It was this post, you were talking about your grandmother. I think it was like a bundle of sage or something like that. It was something, but it was like that conversation was happening. And that is what happened is, I've been preaching since I was 6.
Come on, preach.
Like, huh? Y'all don't want me to preach. I've been preaching since I was 6. Born and raised in the Baptist church. And then I had a theological shift. I spent about 10 weeks in Yahururu, Kenya, and at some point I was in Mombasa, which I was there during Ramadan, and I realized how Christocentric my existence was, that I had never been in a place that was predominantly Muslim, and it was, I knew what I believed, but I didn't have a full context for why I believed what I believed, and being in a space that Jesus isn't the dominant language will kind of force you to be like, wait a minute, people really believe something else. That's a real thing. And when I got back to these United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, I was like,
all of it.
I need to really interrogate this. And I actually went through a slight Hotep phase. It was bad, girl. It was bad. Where Jesus wasn't a thing at all. I was like, the man done got us believing. It's the white Jesus. And I'm a whole preacher. I'm still preaching in the pulpit during this season, to be clear. So like I'm undoing this theology in the pulpit, not in the pulpit, but I'm undoing this theology, and in my real life, I'm also like still preaching. And I came back to Jesus as a, like, Jesus is the, a thing for me. Like, that's the homie. That's my man's in them. We messed with each other. But I don't identify as Christian in the way that I used to, because there is all this, because it feels impossible for me to be talking about ancestral reverence when contemporary Christianity doesn't acknowledge that. It feels impossible for me to be talking about or honoring Orisha, honoring African spirituality, honoring these other, because my undergraduate degree is in cultural anthropology, and for my senior project, for my senior thesis, I was studying voodoo. And then when I went to seminary, I went there, I went to a multi-faith seminary, and which was like, for my family, like, what the F is going on here? You know, I have such song Tourette, because I was about to sing, what the hell is going on between us? That's how my family felt, though, like, what is this? What's going on here? But when I went to this multi-faith seminary, it was like the opportunity for me to really explore different religions in a deeper way. And what I come to understand is that Southern Black Christianity, which is the Christianity that the majority of Black people in the U.S. are participating in, Southern Black Christianity is a completely different Christianity than what most white, you know, Christians are experiencing from day to day. And Southern Black Christianity is basically voodoo. It's basically, you know, Ifa. It's basically Santeria Candomblé. Like, it's all in relationship with each other. And we grew up with so many of these practices, which is what you and I were talking about. So many of these practices, that's just full-blown voodoo. And your grandmother, who was, like, on the motherboard at the church. Like, you know, and so all that to say, I really wish, I feel like it wouldn't have been as hard for my family when I came out not Christian. Mm-hmm. Really coming out, it was hard, too. But I feel like my family wouldn't have taken it so hard if we had been being more honest about our practices and our traditions in the ways that they are not in alignment with some of the Christianity of other the way that other people are experiencing Christianity and or practicing Christianity. And that silence was very hard for me, because I had spent so much of my life, both as a preacher, as a Black woman, as a girl child, trying to please the hierarchy of eldership in my family. And so, and so thinking about the things that, how you would have been using some of your gifts and or maneuvering and moving into some of your gifts a lot earlier if you weren't afraid of the Christian demonic filter that said that those things were wrong. Like, you can't even talk about this. Like, my senior thesis on voodoo, when I was still present, you know, very Christian presenting, was like, we need to plead the blood of Jesus over that. Well, in voodoo, that's what we're going to do too. We're going to plead the blood of Jesus over here too. Like, you know, let's talk about it. There's not even the ability to have that conversation. So I feel like just being able to say out loud that grandma might've got tarot cards read before is like, wait a minute, grandma, what they say?
Finding out until way, I remember being younger, and I remember my grandmother, when people pass away, there are certain things that we couldn't do. So we couldn't point at them. If you point, you have to bite our finger.
Yeah.
My grandma used to light a candle, but she used to always say that she's feeding the spirits. She used to water in a cup.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Used to put it in. She had this like glass.
What do you call it? The cabinet.
Like a glass cabinet.
Okay.
And she had
an altar.
Grandma had a whole altar.
A whole altar.
An entire altar.
Grandma. And
there used to be people, our ancestors, like in like each row, and she used to like add water or whatnot.
Add water and everything.
Grandma had a whole goddamn altar.
I had a whole altar. And now we like starting all of these practices and coming in and thinking that we're doing something new. And it's like, oh, you know, this is why it's so familiar to us.
Yeah.
You know, step right in and go straight to it. Grandma had access. So if grandma had access.
Yeah. You're starting from scratch.
Yeah. I don't have to start from scratch. I already have that. What I have to do is like be still enough to tap in. Mm-hmm. And I have to be like quiet enough, and I have to write, and I have to connect with her, and I have to connect with those that came before me.
But I feel that this goes back to protection, right? But why maintain a secret if it's worked for you for so long? Why would you not want to pass these things down, right? And so underneath that secrecy was a large part of protection. And so, and it's because those practices was not accepted by mainstream society. And so being a Black woman in the South, right, in New Orleans, right, and you practice this, like, you can't outwardly say, yeah, I'm connected to spirits. Not New Orleans, right, where they took voodoo and
converted.
Yeah, converted into something to be negative rather than what is the positivity that it was, like, based upon, right? Yeah. And so that also goes back to the protection. Like, I'm not going to pass this along because I don't want this to hurt them in any way. I don't want them to use this to hurt them or hurt themselves or anyone else to say anything against them, that they're different, weird, anything like that. So I'm going to maintain this secret with myself and not even pass it down to my daughters and or anything like
or
that.
Or even learning that it's antichrist.
Right? Yeah.
I have called that the Christian demonic filter. It's like anything that isn't expressly spelled out in the Bible, our Christian filter automatically is like, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong. And it's not until you start to interrogate the filter, what's being filtered, like going over there to what's being filtered out as wrong and like looking at it and like weeding through it, like, oh, there's a lot of Black stuff. There's a lot of like, oh, that's what's over here in this filter. Now I got to process that. Now I got to be able to deal with that. And like everything that you just said about how there are all these things, think about how your conscious mind wasn't even processing what was happening around you. Meanwhile, there are some things that may have been in secret, but there are some very obvious things that was not, that the Christian demonic filter somehow didn't filter out. And that's like I know this is a very New Orleans thing, but this is a Black thing as well. It's like, you get your hair done, you got to be the one to dispose of your hair. Like, we grew, like,
Yeah.
You can't let anybody get your hair. Like, you got to wrap the hair up or you got to burn it on the stove or whatever. That we grew up with those practices. We grew up with the sweeping practices. We grew up with, my mother was deeply invested in feng shui, but she didn't have that language, of course, but very much like energy in her home was a thing and she would move things. Like, you could go to school at 7:30 in the morning. By the time you come back at 3:45, mama got the couch over there. Girl, who moved the couch with you? Why is this not here? What was wrong with it? It was fine. It just didn't feel, you know.
Cleansing the space, doing all of those practices. My mom can feel when things are wrong. Or she can feel when, like, spirit is present. My mom is... and it doesn't come out until later, but I think she's getting more free with it. My mom will see this video and
I think about your mama. I don't really want to talk about your mama, but I want to talk about your mama from the thing that I DM'd you. That when I saw that little preview, I was like, I know Sister Mary ain't here for this. She said, this is demonic.
I know she ain't here for this. I posted, I was like, my mom been praying for us and praying spirits away all her life. Mm-hmm. Hear her son go.
God bless this ministry.
Calling for a spirit. Yeah. He out there doing undoing all your mama's hard work.
All your mama's hard work. I know. Actually, what I said, I sent it to my group text. Somebody has sent the preview. I sent it to my group text. And I replied, and I was just like, I know sweet sister Mary Abdul-Mateen. did not sign up for this. That is not where she, that's not how she raised that baby. So.
Like, Ma, how you feel? That's crazy.
My family would throw me away. Girl, now that's too far. We don't play like that. Throw me away.
My mom really, I think to go back, I think part of the secrecy was that my mom, I think it became a part of, it doesn't fit our Christianness.
Yeah.
To also this form of spirituality and be Christian at the same time. Mm-hmm. But it works it works in places like West Africa and East Africa, when it's immersed in the culture, right? There's no, oh, I have to name this or separate, like,
who you are. It's all embedded.
That's what it is. That's literally what it is. That's the reason why I'm naming it specifically as Southern Black Christianity, because Christianity in and of itself is not catching the Holy Ghost. There's like, you know, in the charismatic Pentecostal church, when the musicians start playing a certain chord and a certain riff on the, you know, on the bass guitar, whatever, and everybody loses their mind. Guys, that is conjure. That is transpossession. Like, everybody don't just go up at the same time unless this is either learned behavior and or like we have been transported somewhere. And so it's understanding that that is a drastically different Christianity than what most other non-Black people in the U.S. are experiencing. And in fact, we can look at the history of how white people began to have this very charismatic expression is as a result of integration in church spaces. It's not because that's a thing that they were doing. They were absolutely not running around the church. They were absolutely not, you know, banging on the tambourine. They were absolutely not, you know, passed out at the pulpit. That is not a thing that was happening until having relationship with Black people or people of African descent. And so it feels like it's important to have these kinds of conversations, even though they do make us feel uncomfortable sometimes, because we get the opportunity to kind of not even come into new information. It's the coming into remembrance, like, oh, that's true. Like, literally, I was raised like that. I don't even know why I wasn't conscious of how much not traditional Christianity, how much not Protestant Christian, you know, expression I was living into as a Black person in America. And so we got to talk about it more, or, you know, the saints gone.
This is making me want to have an intergenerational conversation with my mom. And just talk about all of these things, you know, understand, because I we still don't understand the secret around it. We just know that there are bits and pieces that she give us. Mm-hmm. And then we go back to where there are bits and pieces that she give us, and then that's it, you know, and then sort of like back away. So I definitely want to like just sit down and have a conversation. I actually think she will enjoy that. Yeah. Like we were talking about my mom getting back to who she was pre-children. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, trying to figure out if that was very much a part of her life, you know, and part of the protection was like getting rid of some of those things. Mm-hmm. Once we came.
Yeah. She used to talk about her gifts. Well, in a more way that underlines like under Christianity, but it was kind of prophetess.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
A prophetess and like speak things that they would have. And so a lot of those experiences she would talk about prior to having us.
Really briefly, I also, like, last night, which is where this is coming up, I looked up hoodoo.
Okay.
Which is not voodoo, but it's very much like root work. And root work, but very much Christian as well. And like, you can still be a part of your religious tradition, but then also understand that you are a spiritual being, that you're connected in a way that you're able to do root work and able to conjure up exactly what you need in order to get things done.
Yeah.
And so when I thought about root work, I was like, oh, that was grandma did.
Yeah, you found up.
I also want to say that I'm interested in how, like, knowing that, I feel like I know the answer, but I would love to hear you speak to this, both of you speak to this, knowing that this is like an off-limits conversation, kind of ongoing, how did you come to that for yourself then? That, like, okay, I know that we haven't been available for this conversation and or we've just not had it at all, but I know there's something peculiar, or, you know, like, how did you come to that for yourself? Because I think so many of us in general are interrogating that. Like, you see it. This is the first generation of Black Christian identifying people who are not participating in church in the same way as we have historically. And so I think that a lot of us are attempting to reconcile ourselves as what our spiritual relationship is, not just with inside this religious experience. So, like, how did you come to that for yourself when it is such a touchy subject?
Yeah,
I've actually began to, so one, Khadija mentioned that we grew up into a religious household, Christian dad, Muslim, so that they've always taught us, that experience always taught us to be open to different things. Like, and this is right, this is wrong, but being like really open. And then after our father passed away, it was kind of like, so in the Bible, it says that, you know, people, you know, on judgment day, if people are saved, you would see them again and things like that. But according to Christianity,
right.
Fit that because he's Muslim. Mm-hmm.
Christianity,
from what we understand. Right. And so I was just kind of like, well, that's, I don't want to believe that, right? I want to, like, I want to believe in reincarnation. I want to believe that my dad is this butterfly that just landed on me, right? Mm-hmm. And then as I got older, like a few years ago, I started having experiences. Mm-hmm. And I started into those experiences. And then I started having vivid, clear dreams that it was kind of like, these are actually messages from spirit that I have to tell other people. Mm-hmm. And then I started trusting that for myself. And honestly, me having those experiences let me know that there's something. I was like, okay, there's something about me that's a little bit different. I didn't even know how to like say it. I was like, there's something about me that's a little bit different. When I write these things down that I dream of, or when I tell people this, that my body calms down. Mm. And that I had to get out. And then after that, then that's when I began to interrogate it more. And then that's when I started connecting the dots from like my grandmother and my mom and stuff. But I think it started off, in short, with when my dad passed away, me leaning into believing. Yeah. And like, I have to have access to him while I'm on this earth. I have to have access to my dad.
That's good.
Yeah, mine was very much similar. And I think as I got older, not having my dad and knowing that, of course, he passed away, and I was like, it didn't make sense. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. Right, it didn't make sense for just him to be gone. And my dad used to always tell us, in the Islamic tradition, you know, when they pass away, they're wrapped up and they put normally in like wooden boxes, and they're buried so they can go back to the earth. Their flesh can go back. And so something else can grow from that.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Another part. So something else can like grow. You know, you become a part of the earth again, and something else grows. So, you know, after that, I was always connected, like, to the earth. I was like, I have to be connected to him in some way. Mm-hmm. And then I got really connected to water. And then I started to feel his presence every time I was by a body of water. And that, you know, was just my thing. Like, I want to go to water. And then when I started practicing yoga, I learned about an altar. Mm-hmm. So I created my own altar, and then I started, I'm not really sure exactly how it happened, but I know I started speaking out loud to my dad, and I write his name down and have his name on my altar. Mm. And then I would have my great grandmother's name on my altar, and I started speaking and then believing that they'll hear me. And then there was frustration because I was like, I mean, I don't know if they hear me or not. I'm not experiencing A, B, and C. I'm not hearing their voice clearly. Mm. I'm not sure how I'm supposed to experience them. But it's sort of like staying in the moment and trusting that there I would think about my dad and the wind would blow really hard. And I'm like, okay, you know, this is what spirit feels like. You know, it comes in really subtle moments. And then I started tapping into other gifts. I started like looking at cards, you know, and my relationship with that was just a whole nother, like a whole nother thing, a whole nother like resistance. Like I had got a particular deck of cards and I was like, I don't want these. I'm taking them back. Right. And then just develop a whole new relationship that way. And then after that, you know, not even wanting to tell my mom anything that was going on at all. Mm-hmm. And then slowly but surely we started talking about, my grandmother passed away.
Yeah.
And so we started talking about ways to connect with my grandmother, which is her mom.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
My grandmother passed away in 2017, the end of 2017. Mm-hmm. Talking about ways to connect with her. And so we introduced that to my mom, like, hey mom, like, this is how we connect with grandma. Like, we speak to her and we talk to her. And then there was one experience where Zakiya was actually telling her experience in that moment and what my grandmother was saying, you know, and then my mom was like, I think it was a part of her that was like, okay, they have it. Mm-hmm. Like, they have the gifts. And then she started telling us more about herself. Yeah. About my grandma. So it all was like a process.
Yeah. I think it was all a process. It seems like that we, now that we're saying, it seemed like it was a solo process.
It was.
Too.
It was very much a, like,
for everyone.
It was very much a solo thing. You were going through your own thing.
Yeah.
I was going through my own thing. And then very recently, we're like, oh, we have a thing that we're supposed to be doing together.
Right. Okay.
That's our gifts. Like, this was, it makes sense. Jeremy is really connected, and, you know, and we connect with him sometime and just have just, like, and just talk and just able to, you know, see things in a different light. So,
and not being afraid of it. I think that's what really, really held us back, is that we're scared.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And if you hear something, be afraid of it. But it's kind of like, but that's my daddy. Mm-hmm. Why am I scared of my daddy?
Yeah.
Why is his voice scaring me? Because he's no longer here, you know, in the physical. Mm-hmm. And like that doesn't seem right. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'm supposed to be afraid of it. I think I'm supposed to lean into this. Mm. Like, I know something.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This actually makes me think about my mother's father transitioned when she was a little girl, but we grew up just thinking about like all the foolish kind of things that we would reject now if we were to talk about it in this way, but we grew up behaving this way. If the wind blew the door closed, my mom would be, or if the wind blew the door open, my mom would be like, come in, daddy. But this super Christian demonic filter that would reject the idea of ancestral reverence, despite the fact that I don't have a lifetime of not being conscious of the possibility of my grandfather's presence, right? Yeah. So how we can, I think it's just, it's a part of our being. What Zora Neale Hurston says, the rocks have memories. And so, so if the rocks have memories, then like obviously our bodies, we can reject it because this doctrine is like suggesting that we reject it. But your body will like
remember.
Yeah. Your body will remember, and you'll just kind of show up as something one day. And
And this thing of like the body remembering all of these things, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
Like when we were younger, we had experiences from spirit. Like I'm pretty sure we had those. And then when we got older, it's like, oh, this feeling is sort of familiar. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's happening and something is moving and I feel it in my body and it feels familiar. Mm-hmm. How does this, you know, what although we may not, our mind may not remember, our body is like stored away. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, this is a familiar feeling.
Or the eternal spiritual memory, possibly.
Yeah.
Because the spirit is eternal. Like, why do I know this thing? You know, thinking about deja vu, which is already seen.
Yeah.
So like I saw that already. How could I have already seen that? Because the spirit is eternal. One of the things that I have done to try to demystify this is going to seminary. You know, I wanted to learn about all the things, and I also wanted to be able to say to my family, "You're not really credible to have this conversation. I'm a theologian." I studied this. You have not studied to show yourself approved. You are not a workman rightly dividing the word of truth. But no, in all seriousness, I really wanted the opportunity to support my family as well on this journey. What does it look like for me to like take scripture and show you that this is in the Bible and that's not in the Bible. You know, some of the things that we have been raised as the gospel is not anywhere actually in the gospel. And very recently, as a matter of fact, and then I feel like we could just talk all night, and I don't want to do that to either of us because, you know, we're supposed to be resting. But I was talking to an aunt recently, and she was talking about worthiness. She wasn't talking about worthiness. She was talking about something that she was going through. And she was like, you know I'm not worthy, but I'm just, and I was like, that's not in the Bible anywhere. That's actually very contrary to what the Bible says. We're like, how are you the apple of God's eye? How are you created in God's image? Like, I've run down, it was about 13 scriptures by the time I got done. And she just cried because she was like, what really came up for her was this revelation that she has spent so much of her life as a Christian woman trying to be more worthy. So that, I always say there was a season in my life where I thought I could special offering my way to a breakthrough. Like, it's one more thing and one more thing. And what we don't realize is what we're doing in this, inside of this Christian hole, is trying to get God to approve of us. Meanwhile, God is like, I created you in my image. Relax. You know, like, I didn't, I didn't say that. Those are not my words. And so you have to contextualize who is actually saying that, you know, that thing that's making you feel unworthy. And that was a major part of what I feel like is my work. My ministry doesn't look like what it used to look like anymore. I'm not preaching in a pulpit. I don't think they've let me in a pulpit, but I'm not preaching in a pulpit in that way. But I'm still doing this work of like, let's talk about this text that is still my sacred text. Yeah. And let's talk about it in a way that we get to trouble it. We get to trouble Abraham as a fuck boy. And we get to also get what was good and worthy of what Abraham offered to, you know, our faith. And like, how do we, you know, chew the meat and spit out the bones and not be unwilling to like recognize that some of the stuff we do have to throw away because it will not work for us. It just will not serve us. We will never be free if we have to see it this way. If we will just never be free. And I don't feel like Jesus was being petty when he said, I set you free for the sake of freedom. Like I'm going to repeat this because I know you niggas will put yourselves back into bondage. So let me tell you that I set you free for the sake of freedom. Please be free. Please, by any means necessary, do that. Of all the things you could do, walk in the direction of freedom. And so I think that one of the things that I definitely walk away from this conversation with is like the very beautiful value of having those conversations with our elders, especially. I think they're waiting for us in a lot of ways. Some stuff they're going to tell us, you're not new to this, you know, like this is not new, but some of the stuff I think will be healing for them. Like, I just never thought of that.
Yeah. And I never blame, you know, my elders for information. I know some people always be like, you know, they didn't tell me this, they didn't tell me that, but there were reasons during the they didn't want to share with their little ones, you know. No, very much for us it was sort of like, how can we protect this next generation? And then older, we're like, well, why didn't you tell us, and different things like that, you know. And I think there are healthier ways to have conversations around like, well, what was going on during this time, you know, like how can we talk about those things now, you know, and how can we dispel some of those some of those myths, or even some of those traumatic experiences? How can we talk about some of those generational curses and sort of like bring it out and like handle it in that way?
And at the same time, letting them know that it's not that you're doing away with anything or undoing anything done. Like, you, what I tell my mom is that I know God, and I'm so happy about the relationship that I have with God, because not this kind of like this structured thing is really open and is really free. And I tell mom all the time, I really focus on like the angels and the angelic realm and the angelic spirit, and not necessarily on like, oh, the devil this and the devil did that. And I really focus it in a different way. But at the end of the day, what she hears is that I still believe in God. Once I'm able to tell her, and once she understands that I still believe in God, she's open to whatever else I have to offer her. My understanding of the other side of that. I think there's this I think there's always been this fear of like not giving us the tools that we need in order to get to heaven. And if something, because I went to divinity school as well, and I know that was very much when I got out of divinity school, that was my mom's fear. I went to Union. So when I got out of Union, I know that was one of my mom's fear. And like, what do you believe? You know, like was you know, and all of those things, you know, but very much trying to protect us from hell, essentially.
Basically, right? Yeah.
I taught a class. You talking about, you know, like that moment of your family kind of being like, okay, girl, you still on the right side? I was teaching, I had a teaching fellowship. I was teaching this Beyonce African Spirit Justice class.
Yeah, Beyonce African Spirit Justice.
And one of my aunts found out about that. She called me and no, first she texted me. Y'all, this is so ignorant. God bless her ministry. She texted me this YouTube video about Beyonce being in the Illuminati first.
Oh, yeah.
Then she called me. We talked for like 5 hours that day. Like, remember back in the day when I used to be like, I watched TV till the TV went off?
Yeah.
That's what happened. We talked on that phone till the phone went off. And just was very deeply concerned about what does it mean for me to even be thinking about, you know, African spirituality. And that was very scary for her. And yeah. I was definitely at that point in my life, still in a place where I was doing a lot of work to be approved of. I just felt like I sounded like a little girl. The little girl in me just showed up. I wanted approval from my family. I did. I wanted to be approved of. I still do. I think we all do. We want our family to, like, the last thing I want to do is bring shame to my family. But also, you know, I do realize that this season of my life is really about realizing that I won't ever be the highest version of myself if I can't tell the truth about, you know, my relationship with God, which is the most intimate, right? Like, Jesus is my ancestor. I could never reject that relationship. I would not be who I am if it weren't for my relationship with Christ. And yeah. And according to this contemporary understanding of Christianity, Jesus was a Capricorn too. So why would I ever stop being a homie with him?
You know, in his 30s.
Exactly. I'm out here doing the Lord's work. Thank y'all so much for this conversation. I had other thoughts in my mind about what I wanted to talk about, but it became the exact conversation I feel like we needed to have. It was very, very beautiful. Thank you.
Yeah, same. I really appreciate you reaching out, you know, or us even connected in this way.
Yeah.
It feels really very beautiful. It definitely feels really good in this moment. But it feels good just to, like, have conversations about our work and to talk a lot of stuff out. We have a lot of stuff to talk about too, huh?
Yeah. I think that's what this is for me. I, you know, jokingly kind of just calling it Zooms with Friends. But where it came from is I was having a lot of conversations with my girlfriends, checking in on me, being here, social distancing by myself. And so just kind of checking in on me. And so, like, how you're just having these conversations and this casual brilliance comes up and you get to the end of the conversation and you think, dang, what would have happened if we had recorded that conversation? Like, what is all the, and I am very much so an anthropologist. And doing the work of archiving on a regular basis, like, my note taking is supreme, and I'm trying to be a part of, in our generation, the ones that's really remembering and documenting our healing work and the ways that we're thinking about things and the ways that we're, you know, just trying to figure out what do we do in these times, especially, like, what do we do in these times? And I feel like some of what all of the conversations that have happened so far, just very easy, like, we just talking how we would talk as homies sitting, you know, sitting somewhere chilling and doing this connection community work. But it's also like the theme that keeps coming up is, like, we're all looking for ways to heal deeper and to grow deeper, you know, now and on whatever is on the other side of this, you know. Because whatever's on the other side of this is just, we'll never be the same. You'll never be the same having to, you know, put on a mask to go to the grocery store. Like, we've not experienced that, you know, as a country in our lifetime. And so we won't ever be the same. We don't even know what our emotional conditions, what mental conditions are possibly being created as a result of the fact that you can't leave out your house right now.
We were talking to, like, I think we all were talking to the other day. We were saying we're actually, like, in it.
Cool. You know? Yeah.
Going on, we probably don't really realize, like, the depth of it because we're actually in it. We're in, like, one of the...
Yeah. We don't even know.
Times. Yeah. That's happening. Yeah, like, we're in it right now.
Yeah, I can't believe I'm part of
it. It's crazy. Like, trying to wrap my brain around it and There is a part of me that is good because I feel like the spiritual work that I've been doing to this point was equipping me for this. So, because of where I live, especially, I've been talking a lot about healing in the hood. Don't talk to me about being a wellness guru if you don't have any language for how what it looks like to heal in the hood. Period.
Period.
But with that, it's like I've been having to figure out how to meditate with sirens all day long, or you know, or how to keep my peace and like the ease that I'm, you know, on a journey to with the pitter patter of little crackheads' feet outside my window. You know what I'm saying? Like, how do you stay in your body as someone who loves Black people and also seeing like great, you know, sadness and sickness and, you know, addiction on a daily basis. And so if you don't have no tips for, you know, if like if you're not talking about that. So I feel like I have been getting to the point where I won't just fall apart when the country falls apart.
Yeah.
Because we can't, right? Like, because we are the healers. We are the ones. Cliche statement. I mean, it's true though. We are the ones, I think, that we've been waiting for. And so it's our time to, you know, be rooted for real.
Waiting for. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I like that.
Yeah, that's a fact, Jack. I'm going to end the recording.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Casually Brilliant, a Zooms with Friends masterclass podcast series with Ebony Janice. A new episode drops every Wednesday at thefreepeopleproject.com. Just click on the Casually Brilliant tab and get ready to be casually brilliant with me. Until next time. To support my work, you can subscribe to my Patreon at patreon.com/EbonyJanice. Subscribers at the $50 or more level get access to all content plus enrollment in my BGM Institute courses on Beyonce and African Spirit Justice and my course on Hip Hop as Liberation Theology. Plus, I have more courses being added in the coming months. Each course is an 8 to 10 week curriculum with a video lecture and all supplemental materials are provided. Again, you can visit patreon.com/EbonyJanice to subscribe. This is a huge beneficial way of supporting my work.